267-456-1000. That's 267-456-1000. Mumia is an elderly man. He is an eloquent radio journalist. He is innocent, framed by the Philadelphia police and Philadelphia establishment. It was the power of the people that had Mumia's death sentence overturned back in 2011. Don't allow them to now execute him through criminal medical neglect.
We blew it in the pandemic. We had this great opportunity to get kids out of their houses safely, to go and explore the world, and we just didn't do it. We quit.
Today we bring you part two of our series on how the pandemic is impacting the struggle for socially just and liberating education in the U.S. and around the world.
It was brutal. It was the craziest negotiation, involved hundreds if not thousands of teachers refusing to go in when they were called back in.
One of the hottest debates in education is when schools should reopen.
And the current government, led by the Sandinista Front for National Liberation, had a very coordinated and massive response to ensure the health and safety of Nicaraguans during the pandemic.
In today's program, we'll hear from visionary activists in the U.S., Nicaragua, and Cuba who push us beyond the narrow focus on whether it's time to return. Instead, they challenge us to never go back to educational inequity and injustice.
It's about freedom in our classrooms from control, to spaces of curiosity and creating spaces where young people can thrive and think on their own and have sovereignty.
In the next hour, we invite you to free your mind and expand your imagination about what the future of education could be. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Beckham and Karen Zapata are social justice educators and activists who see the pandemic as an opportunity to push for new ways of doing school and building relationships between students, adults, and communities. Pacifica producer Ken Yale spoke separately with each of them. First up is Kyle Beckham. He is a lecturer and co-director at Berkeley Educators for Equity and Excellence, which is the teacher education program at the University of California at Berkeley. He also taught for many years in continuation high schools, which are a type of alternative school for students who have not been well served by traditional approaches to education.
What do you think about the ways that educational success and failure have been designed in this country? And if we were operating from a lens of educational equity or social justice, how might we define educational success and failure differently?
Well, so the American school system is fundamentally a competitive system. It's a brutal system. We have, you know, highly standardized systems of grades to sort people out. We have ways of essentially conditioning kids to signal that they are compliant with relatively or not relatively authoritarian structures of schooling. That if you comply with what school asks you to do, you're rewarded and you're given access to higher levels of educational and thus material stability in your adult life. If you don't comply, then what ends up happening is that you're punished relentlessly to the point where you will be at least temporarily or permanently exited from the mainstream mass project of schooling. And It's a highly evolved system. It's very efficient at what it does in terms of sorting kids out. There's a lot of teaching that's happening that has nothing to do with the curriculum itself. It's everything to do with kind of the social teaching, the hidden curriculum. And that hidden curriculum is highly racialized. It's highly a space for downward moving class warfare. But I think the big tragedy is that schooling is largely a place where learning is not the central thing, even though we say that's the central project. There's a far deeper and I would argue more sinister project, which is one of social mobility, of social reproduction, and of breaking what I would say is like our natural inclinations towards solidarity and community, of working together to solve problems and learn from one another. Schools have been exceedingly well engineered to break those bonds. And so projects of mass schooling came about in an era of eugenics, rooted in a eugenic kind of hierarchical ordering of society in which there will be those who do the work of the mind, those that will do the work of handwork, and, you know, a vast middle that will do something in between. We take the hierarchical structure of the classroom as inevitable, the hierarchical structure of the school itself as inevitable. We have even internalized the belief that one's racial identity is what can make one fail in school, rather than the practices, structures, behaviors of those with power in school are the reasons why Black children tend to be failed more in school, or Latino children tend to be failed more in school, or why poor children of all races tend to be failed more, is because of these biases built into the very beginning.
So if we were about creating more equitable and socially just alternatives to the educational practices and policies we currently have, what would that look like?
We've known for quite a long time the things that work well. What works is getting rid of grades, of having apprentice-like relationships between teachers and students, where teachers are sometimes being apprenticed by their students. We know that the best way to evaluate someone is not via a standardized test or a quiz or all of these other things that we know via schooling, but, you know, via projects, via longitudinal things that people are working on that are reflective of their own interests. Personally, so I was at a school where we organized to really be an alternative. Kids could choose from one of six projects every semester. We would do things like look at the history of hip hop. And I would have graffiti artists and DJs and MCs and poets come in and then co-create work with the kids. And then at the end of the semester, what would we do? We would share it with the school community, invite people in. Other projects have the kids going out into the community doing habitat restoration, going to state parks, learning about the geology of the places that they live on, learning about the indigenous communities who were and still are here. And for the kids that had some kind of modicum of outside of school social stability, they thrived. They created things that they were proud of. We as a school said, we're not going to do testing. We're not going to teach history in this like linear way. We're going to do something different, something that makes us as teachers feel passionate, makes us want to come to school every day, and makes the kids want to come to school so that we don't have to rely on the cudgels of grades and the threats of you're going to lose XYZ if you don't come. You know, you would have kids that would stay at school until late at night, kids who throughout their high school histories have been, you know, 50% attenders. There are 85, 90% attenders. It's a feeling. It's a feeling. It's a feeling. And we know these things. We see them. Rich people seem to know about them, and they seek them out and they pay for them. We know that outdoor education is a great thing. And we blew it in the pandemic. We had this great opportunity to get kids out of their houses safely, to go and explore the world, and we just didn't do it. We quit. Instead, what we ended up doing was saying, we're going to do regular school on Zoom. And when it didn't work, everyone was like, well, it didn't work. It must be distance. I don't think it was distance. I think it was simply mapping on the pre-existing paradigm onto Zoom. So it took what was not working and made it even worse. Everything's a race and everything is a competition, and these other countries are going to beat us. And how brutal of a society is that we could tell a 7-year-old that if you don't do well on this test, some kid in another country is going to take your lunch, which is just a foul lie. And we tell it. And we tell it, like, with verve and zeal. And we tell it at a mass scale. And it does a lot of antisocial conditioning to our kids. And it teaches them the wrong things about what learning actually requires.
That's deep and so true. One of the reasons that kids forget the curriculum is that it's actually not culturally relevant or personally relevant to their own lives and experiences and communities.
You know, I'm Black. I don't want to assume that my interests are the same interests as my Black students. I would rather want to learn about them, learn from them, and respond to what it is that they would like to know, more than me being the one that says, like, this is you, this is your history, you have to learn these things. Because there's something that's, I think, lost when we do that. And I really like when spaces are created for Black nerds and Black weirdos to really emerge, to say, like, they like anime, or they like these things that we don't think of as traditionally Black. But that, to me, is relevant and responsive. And that's what they need to thrive. And out of that, I think, comes so much more exchange and discussion and stereotype destruction, I think, when you create a space where kids can be their whole selves. You can be your whole self as a teacher. It's a feeling. It's a
feeling. It's a feeling. That is so powerful. Pick up the newspaper these days, the hottest debate about education, you know, in the mainstream media, is this question of online instruction versus in-person education. But the broader paradigm just is not really questioned, as you brought up.
I really feel like it's a false dichotomy. I actually don't believe that in-person is always better. But the flattening of the narrative is really troubling, because what it ends up doing is it makes us romantic about the way schools were before the pandemic. And the way schools were before the pandemic were frequently very brutal, nasty places full of hierarchy, full of competition, full of kids bullying one another, and teachers, staff, adults, people on the outside of the school turning away from that, pretending it wasn't happening. This happens. Online is going to be here to stay. There's going to be some not insignificant number of kids who cannot safely return. So we have to be thinking about how can we be creative, but we should also be doing that for in person, because the very physical limitations necessary for safety preclude many of the things that we know build lasting relationships, lasting learning, and make school worth going to. And another consequence of all of this is that this is probably one of the most brutal work speed ups for teachers in the history of the profession. We're going to see teachers quit on a huge scale, because instead of protecting the profession and thinking longer term, we've gone so radically short term, because we have a absolutely non-existent social safety net that teachers are supposed to fix everything. And when they can't, they get blamed. It's a lose-lose situation no matter what you do as a teacher. So I just generally really want us to be thinking about how can we use this as an opportunity to really push for new ways of doing school, of new ways of thinking of curriculum, of new ways of thinking of our relationships as between adults, between kids and kids, between kids and adults. How can we make schools more student-centered, more driven by student interest? How can we kind of break the wheel of this college and career juggernaut that we just all kind of have bowed down to and let dominate schools? How can we make schools more focused on actual learning and creating the experiences that are memorable, that stick with kids and with teachers and with families? How can we more meaningfully integrate families into the life of schools? And how can we broaden the purpose without saddling schools with the additional burdens of being the solution to all of America's social problems? How can we create the social conditions for everyone to thrive, for schools to be places where they aren't gauntlets to justify who gets to get a good job and who gets nothing. We need them to be places where people are developed and that people are allowed to pursue things that are interesting and rewarding. I woke up to it, heavy, alive with trueness, always a way of losing, compelled to know it, my body traveled, my mind wasted. There's been a lot of cynical deployment of kids of color in this that really upsets me, because this belief that what kids of color, particularly poor kids of color, need is more school, as school was. And we cannot allow ourselves again to let young people of color be deployed as weapons for that pre-COVID status quo. I really want us to push back against this usage of kids of color as a justification for returning to the way that schools were. They deserve so much more because schools generally serve them so poorly. You cannot expect the problem to magically become the solution all of a sudden without changing the relationship that thing had to those kids. We have to change it.
That was Kyle Beckham, co-director of the Teacher Education Program at the University of California at Berkeley. You can listen to the full interview on our webpage at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Immediately when I hear the word liberated, I think of freedom.
Owning my voice.
When I'm allowed to say what I want.
Being you, that's how you're liberated. That's how you're free.
Liberation starts within yourself.
To be truly liberated, you are accepted. Education.
Liberate myself so that I can then liberate others.
You just have to do what makes you you.
Total freedom. We all need a little bit more of it, you know.
Love yourself and all the things around you.
There's a lot of power in liberation.
Now, Karen Zapata shares her insights and creative vision for liberating and empowering education. She is a veteran English and Spanish bilingual teacher, currently at Berkeley High School, an adjunct faculty in the University of San Francisco's Teacher Education Program, and a co-founder of the grassroots activist organization Teachers for Social Justice.
The pandemic is affecting education much like it's affecting our country and our society and our world, really, which is to say that it has really stopped us in the tracks we were in. And as Arundhati Roy calls it, it's a portal. And I think that in a lot of ways, for those of us involved in teaching for social justice or involved in the educational struggle for social justice, the question really is, where do we go from here? A lot of us have been trying to reimagine classrooms. We've been trying to recreate and recarve our spaces to be liberatory, to be empowering for young people, to be places where young people are seen and recognized and valued for the unique people that they are. So this pandemic is an invitation. I think the biggest issue is the real critical importance of teachers being able to listen, and particularly listening to Black and brown communities. There's a community of white privileged families that are speaking on behalf of communities of color saying we need to reopen our schools. And I think if we listened, we would hear that our schools really do need to change. So in what way are we turning schools into places that Black and brown students are going to return to, thrive, grow, find their voice, and transform our world? And unless we're willing to do that, we are just saying, let's go back to where we started. And many of us don't want to go back there and have been working for a long time to disrupt what used to be. In our organization, we've been working a lot with the idea of freedom dreaming, which comes from the Black radical tradition, which is, what dreams do we have for the young people in our classrooms? What does it look like for Black, brown, Indigenous students to thrive in a classroom?
What are some of the key issues and some of the key demands that emerge from that?
The first is to really dismantle the testing system in our schools. And what we know is that The tests that young people are taking in schools, and particularly the tests for Black and Brown young people, are tied to a very problematic past of our eugenic history in our school systems and our public health systems, which serve to calculate and measure the intelligence of young people as a predictor of potential. And those histories inform us testing in schools is inappropriate. It's unjust. We need to get rid of the idea of measuring young people and instead open up a world of possibility and potential, and to see each young person as having deep and endless potential. Our testing system, number one, works by robbing the humanity of young people, but also in terms of the incredible wealth machine that it is for companies like Pearson. And we really don't have a place for profit when we talk about the potential of young people or educating young people for liberation or looking towards a future that has young people thriving. The for-profit testing systems are not a part of that. And then I think beyond that, I really believe our schools need to be deeply connected to our communities. We never put young people in the classroom in the position of solving problems. Instead, we test them, we deliver curriculum, you know, that we somehow have thought about and come up with, and we don't engage them in these deep problems that exist in our communities. Rather, we have these sort of, you know, pre-thought of curricula. You know, in my freedom dream, what that looks like is, let's take a look at what's happening in our communities. Let's engage young people as problem solvers and have those questions at the center of what we're teaching and learning together, what we're investigating, what we're thinking deeply about. And then let's get out there and interact with our communities.
Very powerfully said. Thank you, Karen, for that.
Yeah.
I know that before the pandemic, there was a growing movement of tens of thousands of parents that took their kids out of the testing regimen. What's happened to that whole testing issue under the pandemic?
I think that's one of the most exciting things, is that I think we're headed to a real disruption of the testing system. There are universities right now that are creating college acceptance programs that do not include standardized tests. I want to think that because we were able to operate schools last year without tests, why go back? Why do we need to go back when we've already done it a year? I want to think it's deeply promising that our communities will start to rally behind disrupting the incredibly profitable and corrupt testing machine.
And are there any other issues or organizations where you see some momentum right now?
Most of the educational activists that I'm organizing with are involved in their union. That's really important, because an organized labor force is really important for our students. It's important for our lives as educators and for our communities. I think a lot of us in the social justice teaching sphere are really thinking a lot about the framework of abolition, the framework of ending systems of oppression within, you know, our education system, ending policing in schools, ending the over-surveillance of Black and Brown bodies in our schools. Many of the social justice organizations are doing things like holding conferences, holding online events, webinars, and a lot of really important analysis is happening right now. I would also say the Abolitionist Teaching Network is an amazing resource, doing a lot of the articulation of abolitionist teaching strategies, and as well as the Education for Liberation Network, another incredibly important social justice teaching organization.
Increasingly, people are familiar with abolitionism as applied to the criminal justice system, but I don't know that people outside of the education circles are very aware of that concept of abolitionist teaching and how that connects.
If we think of abolition as interrupting systems of oppression, our school system is a system of oppression. It's a system of reproduction of the status quo. Our schools continue to produce the same results over and over. And it's what all the hand-wringing is and the anguish about racist outcomes in our classrooms. So really what abolitionist teaching does is it turns our classrooms on their head. It reframes everything and it says, how can I operate from your strengths, from your wisdom, from your beauty, from your knowledge? And rather than having an idea that I'm going to recreate this person, how can I teach from what you know and learn from you? I think that abolitionist teaching, it's about freedom in our classrooms from control. It's about freedom from overly scripted, remediated spaces to spaces of curiosity and creating spaces where young people can thrive and think on their own and have sovereignty.
That was veteran Berkeley High School teacher and activist Karen Zapata, a co-founder of Teachers for Social Justice. Learn more and get active at their website, t4sj.org. Hear Ken Yale's full interviews with Karen Zapata and Kyle Beckham at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
This is for the girls that don't need no makeup when they wake up. For the ones who rockin' lace fronts, you know, I ain't gonna say nothing. Hashtag Neil single. You fresh off the breakup. For the introverts. What's up? No, we don't gotta say much. If you feel free, then you should lift your hand. Real love, less friends. So many things in this world I don't understand. I won't judge who you love or your brown skin.
People get liberated. Get up on your feet if you got the feeling. Hey, get up on your feet. Have to aim to please or be a certain way. Don't aspire to be what you see in the magazines. There's only one you and one me. If you feel free, then you should lift your hands. Want to shake it, baby, like I know you can. So many things in this world I don't understand. I won't judge who you love or your brown skin. People get liberated.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In the 21st century, the battle for a socially just and liberating education has been opposed by powerful billionaires and their allies in government, media, and business. They have promoted neoliberal policies to privatize, standardize, and profit from the public education system. Before the pandemic, they scapegoated bad teachers and their unions as the major reason for educational failure. Now, unions are being blamed as the main barriers to reopening schools. The Chicago Teachers Union, CTU, has been at the forefront of this battle with the education corporatizers.
This is Mario Smith from WLPN Chicago for Pacifica. Recently, the Chicago Teachers Union and the Chicago Public School System reached an agreement to start returning some children to in-person learning, an agreement that came after weeks of bitter public wrangling with Mayor Lori Lightfoot and tough discussions about equity, safety, and social justice. Jesse Sharkey is the leader of Chicago's Teachers Union. Jesse, welcome to the show, and thank you for being on. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think the best case scenario is for students and the idea of returning back to class? CTU battled against CPS, for lack of a better word.
Battle is a fair word. Maybe it was a war or something. It was brutal. It was the craziest negotiation. And, you know, it involved hundreds, if not thousands, of teachers refusing to go in when they were called back in, teaching from outside their buildings, you know, in the snowbanks in the middle of a Chicago winter to dramatize the problems with CPS's plan. The problem with the way the district handled returning is that it was a political goal that was driven by their desire to say, we're opening the economy. It was not centered in a listening, respectful conversation with parents and teachers and other people who are closest to the issue about what do we need to do to give services that are necessary to be able to support and give help to the people who need the help the most. That would have been a very different kind of conversation.
Numbers for COVID seem to be decreasing in the city. There's this move nationally to reopen these schools by May of this year. It seems to me,
when you have a population as large as Chicago's and you have a segment of that population that is refusing to take the vaccine when it is available to them, how do you justify the city requesting that schools are reopened when you still have a high risk of COVID-19 in some of these communities, particularly Black and brown communities?
I don't think there's a good justification. You know, they were fighting to open schools back in early January when the rates were still significantly higher. We waged a longstanding campaign against that, you know, with mass refusals. And we, you know, district drew a whole series of lines in the sand and said, we're going to start locking people out of their remote classrooms and cutting people off pay. And there was over 50 people got disciplined, you know, threatened with firing for, you know, trying to talk to parents about what was unsafe about the situation. It was a big fight. It consumed public attention in the entire city for over a month. And, you know, I don't think there was a good pedagogical justification for that.
Yeah.
I really don't. The proof of that is something that you implied, which is in Chicago, 70% of parents in the city overall chose to stay remote. And the numbers are higher than that, you know, north of 80% among Black and Latinx parents. To me, that was like telling us something about who the people who like were most directly affected by these decisions, what those folks were feeling. They drove us to a point where it was going along open-ended strike to keep schools closed, you know, which would have been a really hard strike.
Just to kind of like update people on what's happening now in terms of the high school kids and their ability to get back into the classroom, how much damage do you think has been done by not having that particular demographic of students in a school?
It's a great question. You know, high school are some of the kids that are most the best able to handle the challenges of the pandemic, most independent group of kids that understand the online medium very well, have high level of reading and analysis, you know, I think are very able to work in a remote setting. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, it's a group of kids in terms of their developmental stage where they're most attuned to social pressures and social groupings. You know, there's a whole lot of things that school provides that aren't necessarily, that don't have to do with academics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think for the students that really key off those areas, it's been really hard. And I think that one of the things that we have lacked in terms of the way as a society we've approached or dealt with pandemic schooling is taking a proper account of which students are succeeding and which students are not getting success at all, are really being harmed by this way of doing school that we're doing. I think if you took that inventory, what it would show you is that, you know, a lot of our socially most vulnerable students, those families are suffering the most. You know, I don't necessarily think that the push to get everyone back in buildings as soon as possible is actually the right question. You know, why not actually take an inventory and say, okay, there's going to be a group of high school students, not all of them, but a group of them who we needed to get back in touch with, you know, and get some face-to-face time with sooner. And I kind of feel like, you know, in a way, we should have been doing that months ago. In terms of the broader question about the buildings, this is the big if. If the virus stays relatively low in terms of how much transmission there is, I think we know and we have some ideas about what needs to happen in our buildings in order to keep them relatively safe. Perfectly safe? No, it's a pandemic, but certainly safer. Mandatory masks, ventilation in our rooms, social distancing, health screening protocols, half of staff and a quarter of students in our high transmission neighborhoods are all being tested, cleaning and disinfecting protocols. So, you know, what we're doing in Chicago, each school has a safety committee, which is a rank and file union-led committee, but the principal and the building engineer have to be on it, which is charged with actually making sure the standards which got negotiated during that big fight are being lived up to in reality in the building. Because left to their own devices, we don't trust them to do that. You know, and then, of course, all based on whether the transmission levels stay low. Because if they go higher, then I think the deal needs to be off. CTU is a social justice union. We don't shy away from that. We say it proudly. Yes, we're concerned about our contract and the terms of our employment. But we're also concerned about the broader set of social good issues in our community, whether people have access to decent housing. That has a big impact on how students show up in a school building, whether people have access to health care, minimum wage. There's a set of issues that our union has taken stands on. We speak openly about racial equity and justice and speak out against racism. And that's actually in our constitution. So the way to understand the CTU is it's not a narrow conception. It's a broad conception that has to do with fighting in the interests of working class people and fighting for policies that protect the public good. What I hope is that not just in the narrow issue of school reopening, but more broadly in terms of what happens in our society about the way we're attending to the needs of working class people during this pandemic. I hope we see a lot more good trouble. I hope we see a lot more people speaking out. I hope we see a lot more organizing. I feel like that needs to happen. And if the CTU contributed in some small way to that, I feel good about that. I do think that's necessary.
Appreciations to host Mario Smith and producer Jamie Trecker at WLPN Chicago Lumpen Radio for that interview with Chicago Teachers Union President Jesse Sharkey.
Feel this from the bottom of my heart, y'all. Truly inspired. Here we go. Come on. Look. Yo. Yo. Teachers are tired. The students dumbfounded. The budgets get cut, so classes are overcrowded. Streets full of violence. The blue coat is silence. So I'ma keep rhyming till salaries start rising. This ain't about money. That's far from the truth. They want better work conditions to teach the youth. Politicians, I don't trust them. It's all in the name. The president, the mayor, all want political gain. They'd rather put the kids in jail, shackle them with chains, than provide an education that challenges the brain. Top-down education, Chicago the birthplace. Now it's spreading nationwide all over the place. They don't teach us how to think, they teach us how to test. They teach us how to work to put money in their checks. The CEOs need to get up out the classroom before these streets get hotter than the sand in Cancun. So join the picket line like Mr. Pickett in his prime. Put on your red shirt like the Bulls in 95. Hit the streets with a sign to say I'm fighting for mine. It's a fork in the road and you gotta choose a side. And yes, I'm proud to say I was a public school student. It was public school teachers that first taught me music. And yes, I'm proud to say I was a public school student. A public school teacher first taught me music. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago.
You are listening to COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Some of the same corporate interests that push the neoliberal education agenda also promote neoliberal policies throughout the world. Nations that resist are sanctioned and attacked by the U.S. empire. Some of the fiercest imperial blows are directed at countries that threaten capitalist control by providing more socially just models to the rest of the world. Our final two segments come from inside Nicaragua and Cuba. These countries have far fewer resources than the U.S., but they demonstrate what nations can accomplish when they prioritize universal education and healthcare over private profit, even in the midst of a global pandemic and relentless imperial attacks. Our first report was prepared for COVID Race and Democracy by Erica Takeo in Nicaragua.
Erica Takeo, North American resident here in Nicaragua for the past few years, and I work in the International Relations Secretariat of the Asociación de Trabajadores del Campo, or ATC, Rural Workers Association, which works with about 50,000 small farmers and farm workers that organize in agricultural cooperatives and in labor unions. In terms of the context here of the education system and COVID, first, it's very, very important to emphasize that thanks to the Sandinista Popular Revolution and the current government, which has been in power since 2007, led by the Sandinista Front for National Liberation, there is the guarantee of two fundamental human rights. The first is universal and free education, and the second is free and universal health care under a community and family-based health model. And in this respect, both the national education system and the national healthcare system had a very coordinated and massive response to ensure the health and safety of Nicaraguans during the pandemic. And also, very important for a country that's a small developing country, ensure that all children, young people, and adults could continue studying during the full time of the pandemic. To give a little bit more context before specifically talking about education, the Ministry of Health had a national response plan to the pandemic in place since January, months before the first coronavirus case was detected here in Nicaragua. It activated its community healthcare model, organizing more than 4 million house visits in the barrios, neighborhoods, and urban areas in the country. They went out into the camp or the countryside and all rural areas of the country to educate about what is COVID-19, its symptoms, what are the preventive measures that one needs to take to make sure that one is healthy, and what do you do if you feel sick. Also, contract tracing was used since the beginning. And thanks to this national healthcare model, Nicaragua was a lot less affected by the pandemic compared to other countries in the continent. To date, there's been 4,829 total coronavirus cases, 165 deaths, 4,609 people have recovered, and this recovery rate represents the highest recovery rate here in the Central American region. Thanks to the socialized healthcare system with a very organized population, COVID affected the country a lot less. Another important thing to note is that part of Nicaragua's strategy was never to go into lockdown, which here is considered to be very important, recognizing that Nicaragua does not have the economic conditions to shut down the country. This is especially the case now with U.S. sanctions that have blocked Nicaragua's access to different types of aid and loans. And so the strategy from the start put in place by the government was that no one here in Nicaragua will die of hunger, and we can't create more burdens on the economy and our workers in an economy that has been slowly recovering since the 2018 failed coup attempt. Now, moving into education, in relation to this general strategy that Nicaragua implemented during the pandemic, public schools never shut down. The majority of Nicaraguan families don't have the conditions to stay at home and do online schooling. For example, lots of Nicaraguans don't have the conditions to have Wi-Fi in their house or to have a laptop for every child that's in their house, etc. And so that it's important for education to go forward that the public schools never closed. On top of that, immediately every public school in the country put in place its own hygiene protocol, so sanitation stations when entering the schools, hand washing stations, lots of education about hand washing and other important prevention methods for coronavirus, the use of masks, training of teachers, distancing of the desks and way that students are seated, sometimes reducing classroom size so to ensure the distancing, and having a program to disinfect all of the schools multiple times every week. Having all of this in place allowed for the education of about 1.7 million students in primary and secondary schools, plus the completely free technical education centers, public universities, and rural schools to continue without any interruption. Another thing important to note is that Nicaragua provides free school lunch to about 1.2 million students every day, and that program never was suspended at any point in time, and that really plays an important role in preventing hunger, food security of all of the students who are learning, and an important component to the development of the country. At the same time, it's important to note that there was definitely a lot of fear on the part of Nicaraguan families during the time of the pandemic, and of course, concern for everyone's health and safety. And so that led some families to voluntarily choose for their child to remain at home, especially during the peak time of the pandemic, which here in Nicaragua was in June 2020. The Nicaraguan government added in what they called a teleclass program that basically implemented nearly 600 classes or class sessions that were transmitted over two national education channels and one radio station nationwide. So these teleclasses were important to reinforce key topics that the students might be learning in the classroom, but also provide an extra place for students to study should their families have chosen for the kids to stay at home for a certain amount of time. However, we just now we're at the very end of 2020, and we just celebrated a very exciting graduation season because of December is when all of the students graduate from preschool, from grade school, from high school, from their technical schools, from university. And there were extremely high graduation rates this year, despite the challenges of the pandemic, which is very, very important in the context of a country like Nicaragua, education to develop the country and move things forward, which is in stark contrast to many countries that completely shut down and students completely lost their school year, which plays a big impact on the development of any individual child, but also on the nation. The only schools that ever shut down here were private schools, which basically required all of their students to have internet in their house, have laptops, etc., and have the conditions to study from home, which, as I had already mentioned, is very inaccessible for most Nicaraguan families.
That was Erica Takeo, National Coordinator of Friends of the ATC, the Solidarity Network with the Nicaraguan Rural Workers Association. Pacifica's Marcos Maldonado and Lena Vasiliev assisted with this production. Cristina Escobar is a Cuban journalist who works for Telesur English and the Cuban Institute of Radio and Television. She filed this report from Cuba for COVID Race and Democracy.
First of all, in Cuba, pretty much all the education is public and free of charge. There are schools in every neighborhood. Cuban school is actually very inclusive, and as everyone has to go to the same school, either if you are the daughter or the son of a surgeon, or the daughter of the son of the owner of a restaurant that makes $2 million a year, which we do have, or if you're just in a family that is working class, then all of these children go to the same school. They wear uniforms and they get books and materials from the school. You enter in a world in which you have to deal with all sorts of people. I feel like this doesn't mean that there's not differences and that these differences are not shocking for children sometimes. And if you go further and you want to study at the university, you have to go through these tests. And according on how you do in these tests is the specialty that you get. This means that the access to higher education is granted through merits and how you do in these tests, and it's not according to how much money do you have or where your parents work. I do understand that if you do better in life, it's also because your social and family environment helps you to do better. Although the access is granted and is free, this doesn't mean that there aren't challenges. It's going to be the first anniversary of the first reported cases of COVID-19 in Cuba. The first lockdown, which was around like a month and a half after the first case, the airports were closed. The health system in Cuba, as you probably know, it works quite well. So you had the possibility of following the web of people, of contacts of a person infected with COVID-19, the level of people getting to critical conditions were very low, and the amount of people who died are obviously, if you compare it to any other country of the world, is quite low. The biopharmaceutical industry responded quite fast with drugs to treat COVID-19, and now, as a matter of fact, Cuba has 5 vaccine candidates. The expectation is that by the summer, massive vaccination will start with a 100% Cuban vaccine. In terms of the school, how has this worked? The schools were closed. They developed a solution of closing the schools but keeping students in class through television. In Cuba, the internet access is not very good. So you have your phone and you can buy packages of data to use in your phone, but it's still expensive. And obviously not every child has access to internet connection good enough to like being on classes. So the solution to actually get to every student that doesn't have internet connection at home or the cell phone or the computer, so it's going to be on television. The entire television programming was reorganized so you could have from physics to biology to Cuban history to Spanish to English, all of that in classes. And there's like a schedule for different grades, so one for primary students, other for high school students. Of course, there are students that don't have televisions at home. I'm talking about like in rural areas or just houses that don't have a TV. So these students are allowed to go to school, keeping all the strict measures. Social distancing, using masks in Cuba is mandatory. In this regard, it was trying to avoid the impact on students. There was a combination of resources being used to keep students engaged in their courses. For the universities, which just a few days ago started the new semester, they're doing it online. Cuba got to internet quite late. It's still expensive and hard because the connection is not very stable and it still costs money. So the solution was to, once you connect yourself through your cell phone to this platform, which is called Evea for classes content, this won't cost. So there's a link between the Ministry of Education and the company that provides the internet service so that students are not charged if they are connected to the platform. The willingness of reaching to everyone is there. The problem is that still is hard because of the access to technology and the very poor internet infrastructure that still exists in this country. There's these daily meetings between the president of the republic and every minister related to these sectors, like education, trade, health, construction. Everyone goes to the same meeting every day. They are reported then on TV. The minister of health gives the entire perspective on how the information on how things went the previous day, and then the decisions of what's going to be done to tackle the situation is discussed in these meetings daily. The strategy is holistic. From the very beginning, it was very clear that masks were going to be mandatory. Also, scientists have been advising the president. So this is very important, this coherence, to actually be able to create a strategy and a discipline around taking care of yourself in a context in which, obviously, the Cuban public health system is under a lot of stress. So the main issue here is to avoid infection, to avoid the transmission, the spread of the virus. The organization in which you have a family doctor, which is a family medical practice that you have very near your home. This doctor knows you, knows like a couple of hundred of people that they take care of. This person searches every day for symptoms. And then if you're sick, this person follows the net of contacts that you have. The perspective has always been to give a coherent and articulated strategy in which everyone follows science in the first place, and then the decisions of the government, which have been extremely advised by scientists. And this has been happening since the beginning of the pandemic in Cuba, and this has helped to make decisions and to give a more coordinated design for this strategy against COVID-19. The first way in which the Cuban education system reflects a commitment to educational equity and social justice is the fact that you always have the opportunity of studying all the way up until you are college graduated or even getting a master's or a PhD for free. And the consequence is, like, for example, more than half of the college populations are women. And the only way in which you can actually be free is if you are educated enough to understand what are the chains that you still have in your life. I do believe that there's a clear, tangible, remarkable commitment that this country has with education and the fact that everyone gets one to be able to be part of the society and being useful. This is one of the countries, I would say, in the world, and definitely one of the poorest countries in the world, that has a higher commitment with education in every level and in every sector.
That was Cuban journalist Cristina Escobar from Telesur English and the Cuban Institute of Radio and Television. Pacifica's Marcos Maldonado and Polina Vasilyev assisted with the production. While every resident of Cuba and Nicaragua gets free education and health care, those of us in the U.S. aren't so lucky.
A lot of kids are expensive, though, man. People put pressure on me. Financial pressure with my son. Are you saving up for his college yet? I need to pay for my college, man. Are you kidding me? I'm going to have to walk him up through the financial aid line to the people I still know. Yeah, I got tab going, right? We're good. Yeah, no, turns out I am alive. That cast in the cradle song's going to be totally different, you know? Boing, boing, my son went to college the other day. but I still have my own student loans to pay. Well, the check's in the mail and the bills are due. The interest on my loans continues to accrue. When you're catching up, that I don't know when, but we'll be filing Chapter 10, yeah.
That concludes part two of COVID Race and Democracy's education series. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and Ken Yale, with contributions from Marcos Maldonado, Ursula Rudenberg, Mario Smith, Jamie Trecker, and WLPN Chicago Lumpen Radio. Artistic contributions were from Pink Floyd, Dege Loaf, and Leon Bridges, Don Friesen, Rebel Diaz, Juventud Sandinista, 19 de Julio, Los Van Van, and Shabazz Palace. The executive producers of COVID Race and Democracy are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. Learn more and get involved through our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. That's also where you can find part one of this series, which was broadcast on January 4, and the full interview with several of today's guests. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.
Sometimes it seems almost selfish to expect from someone more than we have the right to. But we ourselves may be more than selfish in our demands. And you whispered love to me so softly that I could almost feel its ring. You whispered so softly, words that I can feel. You told me you love me, and that there's no one else but me. You are nature's own self, just like a book up on my shelf. So naturally, I know this world will see that our love, our love, our love, our love, our love, our love will last forever and ever. Will last forever and
fight. I'm already low. I think to winning. I can't ever do right. I can't lose this fight. I'm already lost.